The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors. Keep on, keep on.
All right, good morning and welcome to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. I'm Sean Sayre here with you on a snowy Friday morning. It's Friday, December 16th, and you know, if you happen to be up overnight and looked out your window, you probably didn't see a lot going on out there. It was maybe a little bit of rain, maybe a little bit of slushy stuff out there, and then around 6:30, 6:45, started seeing those big snowflakes coming down, and probably for the last 45 minutes or so, it's snowing pretty hard out there right now. So if anyone was thinking the storm was going to be a bust, you might have been a little off the mark. Who knows what's going to happen during the day today, though. We are hearing some mixing of rain and snow and then turning to all snow later on tonight. But, you know, things move on. We keep going. And Berkshire snow, that's the way it is. I've got a great guest here for you this morning. Live here in the studio, we have Chief Michael Wynn. He is the chief of the Pittsfield Police Department, and a couple of things to talk about with Chief Wynn this morning. Going to be interesting. I originally thought we'd bring him in and talk about his upcoming retirement in July of next year, which is a long way off, but... And then we got a little news last night that we want to talk about and lots of other good stuff. So looking forward to that conversation with Chief Wynn. First, let's bring up the weather. And unfortunately, we don't have a Jacob forecast this morning, but we'll go back to our weather robot and let you know what's going on. Here we go.
Berkshire weather.
WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Winter storm warning in effect until 10 a.m. EST Saturday. Today, rain or snow. Snow accumulation of 2 to 4 inches. Breezy. Near steady temperature in the mid-30s. East wind 15 to 25 miles per hour with gusts up to 40 miles per hour. Chance of precipitation near 100%. Tonight, snow or rain in the evening, then snow after midnight. Total snow accumulation of 6 to 10 inches. Cold with lows in the upper 20s. Northeast wind 15 to 20 miles per hour with gusts up to 30 miles per hour, becoming northwest 5 to 10 miles per hour after midnight. Chance of precipitation near 100%. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
Yep, and so 6 to 10 inches is what we're looking at right now. We'll see how that pans out. It was good to talk to Ricardo Morales yesterday. Also, another timely interview that we had talking about preparations for storms like this, and I'm sure all the guys are going to be out on the road today, plowing and keeping those roads clear. On my way in again, pretty clear and pretty drivable. But as always, your mileage may vary, as they say.
They were out last night retreating. Yeah, getting some solution down on the roads, keep it from sticking.
Yep, I saw some sand and salt and grit and things too. I think that early part of the weather was definitely, preparation for slick conditions, and now it's just straight snow. We know how to drive in snow.
Most of us remember how to drive in snow. Today will more likely than not be a busy day for the officers on duty on the PPD.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that. So, Chief Wynn, thanks for being here. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm not used to being in the hot seat. Usually I'm the one throwing questions at people now.
It's a different feeling,
right? It's a different feeling.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're certainly going to get into some other stuff, but talk about, since it's a very timely issue, a big snowstorm comes, and your department has to deal with maybe some different situations and conditions that come up as based on the storm. What happens in something like this?
So before we came on the air, you and I were talking about, the sore subjects that's come up in the last week is the lack of progress on a new station.
Yeah.
And so for the police department, when we know that we have a weather event coming, there's internal preparation and external preparation. And the internal preparation is actually more difficult. So because of where our headquarters is located and because of the configurations of the road and because of the number of vehicles in our fleet and the lack of parking, the internal preparation is getting all of our extra cars and surplus cars relocated. Huh. We have to get them somewhere out of the weather, so shuttle those. And then making sure that all the cars that will be on the road are ready. So making sure that, the tire pressure is right and they've got a solution for the windshield wipers and all that stuff. And
how many cars is that?
On the front line, on a normal shift, we're running 6 cars and 2 supervisors. Mm-hmm. So 8 cars in patrol plus traffic. Mm. And so we have to make sure all those vehicles are ready. And then depending on the timing of the weather event, the shift supervisors and commanders will put instructions out. And it seems counterintuitive, but the worse the weather gets, the closer to the station we keep our people. Hmm. Like we try to reduce the amount they're driving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously they're going to answer calls for service and they're going to be out there doing their checks, but we don't want them, you know, driving to the far fringes of their beats, checking parking lots. It's impossible to get back in.
Mm.
So you kind of have to muster your resources and be ready for whatever happens mm-hmm. next.
Will an event like this change the behavior of any folks in the community where the police might have to get more involved in certain things? Does it keep things a little quieter?
Back in the day, we used to say so, but not lately.
Yeah.
You know, our call volume is pretty constant. We used to say that, you know, everything dropped off activity-wise when the weather got really, really cold, but that's not the case anymore.
Mm.
And I hadn't thought about it in a long time. You would think that in a weather event like this, people would be like, oh, I probably shouldn't do bad things. The police will find me. But one of the easiest commercial burglaries, breaking and enterings I ever saw happened when I was a patrol officer on what was Auto 2, so West Housatonic Street. They B&E'd Jake's during a blizzard, and we just followed the sled and footprints to the house. No canines. Yeah. We just walked.
Kind of obvious at that point, right?
Yeah. Like, you know, I'm not sure what you thought you were going to get away with.
So, Chief Wynn, let's take it back a bit. And you mentioned your days as a patrol officer. Let's go back further than that and
sure.
talk about how you got interested in law enforcement to begin with, and your time sort of growing up and, you know, getting into the programs that got you where you are today.
Sure. Well, I'll start with the first part, and then I'll do the where I grew up thing. I've told the story publicly a couple times, and people don't believe it. I came to law enforcement by accident. It wasn't in my plan.
Hmm.
So I grew up in Pittsfield. I own a home and live, a couple hundred yards from the house I grew up in the same street. Pittsfield schools for most of my time, 2 years in, 1 year in Lenox and 1 year in Lee, and then back to Pittsfield. Graduated from Taconic, class of 88. I refuse to use the new name. I'm sorry, but proud brave. Left high school, or was getting ready to leave high school, and had decided that I wanted to be a military officer. And so I was pursuing service academies. And I had appointments potentially to the U.S. Military Academy, the U.S. Naval Academy, and the U.S. Coast Guard Academy.
Hmm.
And I distinctly remember the day. So I wanted to do something afloat, so I eliminated the point. And I distinctly remember sitting at my parents' kitchen table looking at the appointments from Navy and Coast Guard. And this was the late 80s, the height of the war on drugs, Miami Vice. And I made a decision that I did not want to be a cop. And so I went Navy instead of Coast Guard, which is ironic because fast forward a couple of years, I would have been a much better experience in the Coast Guard.
How do you think that would have been different?
Well, so eventually I was not able to commission in the Navy or the Marine Corps because I sustained an injury.
Mm.
And that precluded my military career, and it wouldn't have precluded my service in the Coast Guard. I could have stayed in the Coast Guard, but I had to leave the military.
Yep.
So I left high school and went to the Naval Academy for my plebe summer in 88. And I thought I was a member of what we called the Top Gun class. So I thought I was going to, be a backseater, Rio, for Naval Aviation, except I had really bad eyes. And I had only been at the Academy for a matter of days. Shout out to one of my Facebook friends. He was at the time second class, Spencer Crispell. He showed me the error of my ways while I was in front leaning rest, getting quizzed on my daily knowledge. And he said, everything in your life up to this point, Boy Scouts, backpacking, rock climbing, whitewater rafting, you're a Marine, you're a grunt, you're not an aviator. And so during plebe summer, I decided that was what I wanted to do. Instead of trying to get into a cockpit, I was going to become a Marine officer. I changed my major from chemistry to English. And so I was a humanities major at an engineering school who wanted to work with people. And during my second summer of my cruises, I realized that the academics, they weren't for me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to quit as a plebe. And so I got back, the brigade reformed, and I started my third semester. And one night I was just sitting in my room, and I had like 6 hours of engineering homework, and I hadn't started my humanities homework. And I said, that's it. I need to go to another school. I had a English professor at Navy who was a Berkshire part-time Berkshire resident. Her husband was on the faculty at Williams. And she asked me in class one day what was wrong, and I told her, and she's like, so go home and go to Williams. Hmm. Like, it would be that easy. So I took the rest of that year off, and during that year I applied to, and I was fortunate enough to get accepted to Williams. So I transferred into Williams as a sophomore, started my third semester over again, and graduated from there.
Those kind of changes feel much bigger, I think, when you're younger, too, right?
Yeah.
As you get older, you realize that all those things sort of fell into place and made sense. But at the time, it probably felt very monumental, right, with that kind of change.
Had I sustained the injury I sustained during OCS when I was still at the Naval Academy, they would have put me in the restricted line. I would have been in the supply corps. Mm-hmm. But because I had gone to Williams and I was a reservist, not active duty when I sustained the injury, they just discharged me. So it completely worked out. I had a mentor at Navy who is my mentor to this day. He had retired from the Army and cross-decked over to DEA as an enforcement specialist. He was teaching agents skills so they could go down to South America. And he wanted me to come work with him, and they wouldn't, in the early 90s, DEA wouldn't take you unless you had military or law enforcement.
Okay.
And so I did what any college kid does when they don't have a job. I came home, and I started looking for jobs, and I was fortunate that the timing worked out. I got home in the fall of 93, and the Pittsfield Police Department was advertising for a part-time position in their grant programs in community policing, and I applied for that job and was selected to go head the Westside Neighborhood Resource Center as the first director. I did that part-time for a year and then helped rewrite the grant and turned it into a full-time job. So I went to work as a city employee in 94, and I did that until I was picked up and selected to go to the academy. And so I went to the academy in 95 and hit the road as a patrol officer in 96.
Wow, so those early times of the Pittsfield Police Department, who was the chief at that time?
So I worked at the Resource Center and went to the academy under Chief Jerry Lee, and I graduated from the academy under Chief Tony Riello.
Okay. And so that was sort of the genesis of it, right? You got in, and it was a grant program that it sounds like a very progressive program at the time, too.
We were doing amazing work in the early to mid-90s.
Things that hadn't really been thought of or done before. And it's like, okay, no, this is going to work here in this community.
The Department of Justice opened the spigots up on the community policing money. And so we were receiving considerable federal funding to expand our community policing programs. We did a downtown directed patrol. People don't remember that. We had four officers who were assigned just to the North Street corridor for several years, working with our friends from Berkshire AHEC, my friend Wendy Crom. We brought National Night Out to the city. We ran that for several years. We started our community police academy into an educational program, and we expanded our programs in the school. So, we were doing some really interesting non-enforcement stuff as long as that money lasted.
Well, talk about community policing itself and the ethos of it, right? And how it's different than traditional standard police work. Why is it important for this community?
So, I mean, this is where I started, and it's always been one of my passions, but it's also something that's incredibly misunderstood. And I was just talking to a staff member earlier this week before we went out to the coast, because they were dealing with, you know, part of community policing is problem solving. It's looking at root causes and trying to get to the underlying problem. And so he was looking at a particular traffic related problem, and it's a problem, but it's not like an earth shattering problem. But there's a couple different solutions. One solution is we can pour police resources into it, and that's an imperfect solution because it's not, well, it's important, it's not an operational priority. And so it's always going to take second seat to something else. And so sometimes we can do it and sometimes we can't. But the other solution is we partner with the community and neighbors step in and help us. And so in this particular conversation, we've put that out there and offered it. And in this case, the response is, no, you do it. Like, then you don't understand community policing. Right? Community policing is we identify a problem, we identify the root causes, and we find the best stakeholder. And we admit that in some cases, it's not us. Right? So it takes community to do community policing. We can't community police from the police perspective.
Give me an example of a program like that. That was, you know, sort of successful and on the ground here. There's probably multitude of them, but so something that really rises to the top in your mind.
Probably the best example we have here in the city is our Neighborhood Watch programs. And, you know, Neighborhood Watch, it ebbs and flows depending on the interest of the neighbors in the neighborhood. And so when I meet with the community group and they're inquiring about a neighborhood watch, like, we want neighborhood watch, what do we do? My response is, I don't know. You tell me what you can do and what you want to do. And so we have neighborhood watches that we're very active in, right? They expect us to come to meetings several times a year, and we exchange information. And that's one model. It works. If the people who are driving that move away, our experience is that that watch will fold up. On the other hand, we have a very, very active and long-lasting watch right here in the Orchard section. We're not involved in that watch practically at all. They organize themselves. They have regular meetings. They invite us to come maybe twice a year for holidays and barbecues. But they copy us on all their communications. And so if you're in the Orchards and you're behaving in a way that attracts a resident's attention, you can be certain the police department is going to become aware of that very quickly. But they're not going to notify us first. They're going to notify all their neighbors first.
Okay.
And then they'll notify us. And most of the time, by the time we come out and check with them, that problem has self-corrected because somebody has approached the stranger or has approached the vendor and say, hi, you know, I'm so-and-so from the neighborhood watch. Can I help you? And if that's a bad actor, they're not going to stay in that neighborhood. They're going to go somewhere else.
Yeah, interesting. And so I would imagine that also is tied into how tightly knit a neighborhood is, right? And we've seen a lot of changes in our culture and neighborhoods, and a lot of times people, you know, the doorbell rings, and instead of running to the door like we used to when we were kids to open the door and find out
turn
who's
off
there.
The lights.
Yeah, we're like, who's that? Open the curtain.
Check them on the Ring doorbell.
Yeah, you know, and a lot of times people just don't know their neighbors anymore, right? And people come and go in the neighborhood, and you don't necessarily, you know, bring a pie over next door to welcome them anymore. It's just different.
So it's funny. I hadn't thought about this in a long time. So when I was at the Resource Center in 93, 94, 95, one of the things we did is we created a neighborhood newsletter and tried to get it out monthly. Sometimes it was every other month. But in one of the first, in the name of the, because of where we were located and what we were, and the fact that at the time the Riverside Bar was still there at Columbus Ave. And so the name of the newsletter was Down by the Riverside. And one of the first articles I wrote for that newsletter was Be a Nosy Neighbor. Is it, you know, the success of Neighborhood Watch depends on me looking out for my neighbor and my neighbor looking out for me.
And of course, the key is to watch, but don't necessarily take matters into your own hands, right?
We're not recruiting or encouraging vigilantism.
Right.
It's, you know, pay attention, know what's going on in your neighborhood, and if something's off base, let us know so we can come assist you.
We're speaking with Chief Mike Wynn from the Pittsfield Police Department here on Morning Drive, 89.7 WTBR-FM. And so, Chief Wynn, take us past those early days now when you sort of got into the vibe of being a police officer. And then when was the first time that you sort of got into a leadership role?
So I got out of the academy in the spring of 96, and just to remind you, fully intending to leave. Like, I was pursuing jobs with federal agencies.
Interesting.
And so a couple different things happened. I was a candidate for DEA, and at the 11th hour, that didn't work out. I wasn't offered the position. I was a candidate for Border Patrol, but I had bad eyes, and I couldn't pass their vision test. And so a handful of those opportunities just didn't work out, and I was frustrated. And then I realized, you know, I wasn't going to be packing up and leaving right away. I had this job. I had to do the best I could at this job and focus on this, and the opportunities might present themselves. So after that last of those opportunities evaporated, I approached my commander at the time, Lieutenant Bruce Hugabone, and I said, look, this is not working out. I'm going to be here. You know, what do you need me to do? And I had some, the lieutenant knew that I had some teaching experience because I was a scuba instructor at the time, and I had already been working with the special response team, teaching them high ropes because I had been a rock climbing and rappelling instructor in college. And so he said, okay, you know, we've been talking about this, and if you can tell us you're going to be here, we've got an idea. We need some instructors. And so that first year, it would have been 96, 97, they put me on the road, and I was on the road like every 3 weeks for the better part of like 8 months. And I went to a couple different defensive tactics instructor schools. I went to firearms instructor school, and by the, like, you know, 90 798 time period, I was a subject matter instructor in most of our physical skills. And so I became collaterally assigned to the training unit, and I was a primary firearms instructor, defensive tactics instructor, patrol procedures instructor. And so that was really my first leadership role. And then I was selected for the second group of officers in the department to be formally trained as field training officers. And so 97, I started taking new academy graduates under my wing and training them up. And so I was a field training officer until I made rank.
And was that a fairly common thing to have a lot of internal training at the time, or was that something that the police department in Pittsfield was doing sort of more of around that time period? Was it more common to do training internally, or did you have to do more of it externally?
So the department had a history of having an internal training function, but the people who had been in that when I got out of the academy, they were veteran officers, senior, with a lot of rank. And they had been pulling back from it, and there hadn't really been any steps taken to replace it. And so we were sending a lot of our people out for in-service training, and the quality of the in-service training wasn't great. So Chief Riello directed me to start trying to bring it back inside. And so we started trying to develop our internal in-service training programs. And that went with fits and starts. We had some pushback from the union as far as how we scheduled it and structured it. And for a long time, we were doing it in 30-minute blocks following roll calls. But we kept we kept at it. And eventually, we got back to essentially a full-time training officer. And we do all of our in-house in-service training now. And all the stuff that we would have used, we would have sent people out for in-service training, regular update training. Now we use that for specialized training. So we doubled our capacity to train.
Well, and that's obviously very important to keep skills sharp while you're and you have a long career now, right? With the how many years total in the Pittsfield Police Department?
27 with the department, 29 with the city.
You know, and over that time period, I'm sure not only were you a trainer, but you were also a recipient of a lot of training to move through the ranks as you did, and eventually achieve the chief of police.
This is one of the things that I don't think residents understand enough. Training, constant repetitive training for police officers is vital. It's vital. Everything that a police officer learns in the academy, with the exception of, you know, the baseline book knowledge, is a perishable skill. And when it doesn't get refreshed and it doesn't get updated, it gets sloppy. And particularly in physical skills, apprehension skills, when you start sloppy, they don't work right. And then the response is almost, if not a panic attack, like anxiety. And that's when situations escalate and they always look bad. As a trainer, one of the things, particularly when we train outside, you know, through some of the martial arts programs, one of the common things within the training industry is ineffective force often resembles excessive force. When you're trying to do something and it's not working and it persists and persists and persists, it's just bad. So being able to do it right the first time minimizes the duration and the severity of those altercations.
And that's that training that helps you in those split second moments, right? Where you just have to rely on that training and to react in that amount of time.
And so training is key. I remember one of my first budget processes with Mayor Roberto, and you know, give me a 5% reduction, give me a 10% reduction, what is this going to look like? And, you know, and
those are different times, weren't they?
They are different times. And so looking at cutting staffing. And so he's like, well, this doesn't make any sense. If your numbers go down, this training budget should go down. I was like, no, if you reduce my numbers, the training budget's going to go up. Right? You give me less people, I'm going to give the remaining people more training. And so he accepted that. But that's been our philosophy, is training is vital, and we are constantly trying to increase the amount of training.
So over the years, you moved through the ranks, and in the mid-2000s, I want to say, you were appointed by Chief Roberto, I'm sorry, Mayor Roberto as the chief of police, the interim chief of police for a while, right? And that's due to the mysterious civil service procedure that we have here in Massachusetts. So talk about that and how that worked out at the time.
Yeah, so I made sergeant in 2001, and then I made lieutenant shortly after I came back from Quantico in 2004. And then I moved upstairs as a interim captain, an acting captain, in the beginning, or the, I'm sorry, the summer of 2007. And then November 1st, 2007, Chief Riello called me to his office and shared the news with me that he was leaving on December 1st, and there was going to be a change of command, and the mayor wanted to speak to me.
Wow.
And so I went across the street.
It was a momentous day, right?
It was a scary day. And I won't get into the decision making process. Yeah. I was the junior captain. I wasn't even a permanent captain yet. But for reasons that I won't get into, my name had been put forward. Mm-hmm. And so we went across the street, and at the end of a meeting with the mayor, you know, I was told that on December 1st, I was going to take command.
Wow.
And Mayor Roberto was up front with me. He's like, you're going to take command, but I am not going to appoint you as a civil service chief. Mm. And so I took the job with the understanding that at least as long as he was my boss, that wasn't going to happen. And I was okay with that. Because civil service is a mystery. It doesn't make a lot of sense to a lot of people. Right. But the position is in the code, a civil service position. And so eventually we're going to have to reckon with that.
Yeah.
And so
that's in the code of the city of Pittsfield, city code. Right? So even though we have a new charter in the last 6 or 8 years, that wasn't dealt with at that time.
Yeah. And so civil service is a state process. Mm-hmm. And you have to, if you want to come out of civil service, you have to come out of civil service the way you went into civil service. And so the chief's job had come out of civil service at some point in the 70s or 80s. Mm-hmm. And then they put it back in by referendum. Mm-hmm. And so it's a political process to take it back out.
Sure.
And so we need the delegation. And
And I suppose the idea of putting civil service in is supposed to take politics out of the selection process, right? That's the idea.
That's the intention.
But what does it actually do? Does it help or hurt overall, in your opinion?
Civil service was a great idea when it was conceived. But it's a great idea it's seen its day. Mm. And so civil service was created to take the politics out of these important appointments, and it was also created to create some standards and consistency across the board and to offer workplace protections for people so that they weren't serving at the whim of political, either elected officials or appointees. And that's good. But with union protections and labor laws now, a lot of what's been placed for civil service is almost redundant. The other part of it is the bureaucracy that is civil service, how the tests are scheduled, how they're administered. Mm-hmm. And over the course of my career, the service we get from civil service has been reduced dramatically, but the constraints have been increased dramatically. So we're getting less out of it and putting more into it. Mm.
And that has an effect on being able to recruit and bring in new officers as well, right?
Yeah, because it delays all the timelines. Mm. And so when I made sergeant, I was promoted off of a civil service list that was entirely based on a written test. And so the civil service office from Human Resources, they send out an announcement. It's got a reading list. You read all the books. And it's a general knowledge test, and it doesn't require you to demonstrate any skill or proficiency. Mm. And in hindsight, and I look at the reading list from time to time, nothing that I studied for the sergeant's exam was useful as a sergeant. Huh. There was a lot of special criminal investigative techniques, and there was a lot of management stuff, but there was no first-line supervision, leadership stuff included at all. Huh. And so we're testing for things that aren't going to be in the job set so much. So a few years ago, we're still in civil service, but we got rid of the written test for lieutenants and captains. We asked civil service to work with us to select a vendor, and we administer assessment centers. They're day-long situation-based exercises that the candidates have to go through. Huh. And instead of being graded on a couple hundred question written exam, they're graded on their performance in these exercises.
Hmm. You would think that would be kind of obvious, right?
You would think, but it's expensive and it takes more time. Small departments are just like, no, drive to Springfield and take the test. Mm, they'll send us a list. Mm-hmm. So it gets frustrating because it does impose a lot of artificial time constraints that we have to work through and around.
Interesting. We're speaking with Chief Mike Wynn, Pittsfield Police Department, on his career, and we haven't even started talking about a decision to retire, and we got so much to talk about in the second half. We're coming up to our top of the hour break already, believe it or not. I knew that was going to go fast. And so let's do that now. Let's take a quick early break, and then we'll come back at the second half of the program here on Morning Drive. Again, if you're just waking up, you're waking up to some heavy snow outside as I'm doing my interview here with Chief Wynn. It has not stopped snowing, and it's pretty strong out there. So just be careful on the roads if you're leaving now, and if you're hearing me in the car, well, first of all, thank you, and second of all, be safe out there. Okay, we'll be right back after this quick break on Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR-FM.
Stay tuned for more Morning Drive here on WTBR FM.
The Berkshire's only rock station, 89.7 WTBR FM, Pittsfield, Massachusetts.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Mantiques, a 7,000 square foot shop featuring collectibles, antique signs, and much more for your garage, bar, man cave, or she shed. Open Thursday through Monday from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. and located on Route 7 in Lanesboro. And from Greylock Grounds Drive Through and Cafe, featuring different varieties of local coffee and tea from Six Depot Roastery Cafe. Greylock Grounds K-Cups are locally brewed and the only biodegradable compostable K-Cups using a local roaster. Visit their drive-through location on Route 7 in Lanesboro, serving coffee, paninis, ice cream, and more.
Hi, this is Josh Cutler. On behalf of the Jewish community of Berkshire County, I'd like to wish all listeners of WTBR-FM a happy and joyous Hanukkah season. This year promises to be one with many exciting community celebrations. May this Festival of Lights be one that is filled with family, friends, great food, and great spirit. L'chaim.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Mantiques, a 7,000 square foot shop featuring collectibles, antique signs, and much more for your garage, bar, man cave, or she shed. Open Thursday through Monday from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. and located on Route 7 in Lanesboro. And from Greylock Grounds Drive Through and Cafe, featuring different varieties of local coffee and tea from Six Depot Roastery Cafe. Greylock Grounds K-Cups are locally brewed and the only biodegradable compostable K-Cups using a local roaster. Visit their drive-through location on Route 7 in Lanesboro, serving coffee, paninis, ice cream, and more.
Hi, it's Jen Glockner. I'm the Director of the Office of Cultural Development for the wonderful city of Pittsfield, and I also host the Cultural Pittsfield radio show on WTBR. It airs every Friday at 8:30 in the morning. Stay tuned to learn all about the arts and culture scene for the city of Pittsfield and beyond. We hope you listen in every Friday at 8:30 on 89.7 FM WTBR.
Hi, this is Sean Sayre, Executive Director of PCTV. When Taconic High School was demolished, we could have lost this radio station. Instead, PCTV stepped in, built a new studio and transmitter, and gave the station new life. And now it's time to pay that back. Support this station today. Go to WTBRFM.com and click the donate button. You won't be sorry. Pittsfield Community Radio thanks you for your support.
The community is invited to attend the annual Kwanzaa celebration hosted by the Women of Color Giving Circle of the Berkshires at 6 p.m. Thursday, December 29th. The event, which will be held at 741 Tyler Street, will feature dynamic speakers Amy D. Griffin, Esquire, and Kiana West, a thrilling musical performance by Christine Bile, and an original skit performed by Rites of Passage and Empowerment Scholars. For more information, please contact Shirley Edgerton at 413-496-4602.
Radio for people who used to love radio. Welcome back. WTBR.
And now back to the Morning Drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
All right, welcome back to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. Sean Sayre here with you on a snowy Friday morning, Friday, December 16th. And yes, snowing and going to snow the rest of the day, pretty much some rain in there and then some more snow. You know how it is. Let's listen to the weather forecast real quick before we get back to our interview with Chief Wynn of the Pittsfield Police Department and find out what's going on outside your window today. Here we go.
Berkshire weather.
WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Winter storm warning in effect until 10 a.m. EST Saturday. Today, rain or snow. Snow accumulation of 2 to 4 inches. Breezy. Near steady temperature in the mid-30s. East wind 15 to 25 miles per hour with gusts up to 40 miles per hour. Chance of precipitation near 100%. Tonight, snow or rain in the evening, then snow after midnight. Total snow accumulation of 6 to 10 inches. Cold with lows in the upper 20s. Northeast wind 15 to 20 miles per hour with gusts up to 30 miles per hour, becoming northwest 5 to 10 miles per hour after midnight. Chance of precipitation near 100%. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
All right, there you have it. Stay safe out there on the roads today, and just be situationally aware, as you will, driving in snow and slush and ice. A little different, so keep that in mind, and you know, don't plow into me, please. So welcome back to the show. Chief Wynn, thanks again for being here today with us.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. So a little bit of news dropped yesterday. We might as well start the second half hour with that. A big honor. You were named Police Chief of the Year by the Massachusetts Chiefs of Police Association. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's amazing.
It's humbling.
I'll bet. And I'm sure you're, you know, not wanting to boast about it, but, you know, I think it's time to celebrate that our chief of police here in the city of Pittsfield is taking this award, and I think well-deserved. But
thank you.
Tell us about the association and how you're involved with it and what type of honor this is for people that don't understand.
There's a lot of labor associations and fraternal associations within law enforcement, and I'm fortunate to be involved in many of them. But the Massachusetts Chiefs of Police Association is the overarching organizational structure for all police chiefs in the Commonwealth. Mm-hmm. And they're obviously a fraternal organization, but they also have a training and support branch that we get a lot of our in-service training materials from, policy development stuff. They provide legal counsel to chiefs, and they have a lobbying effort on our behalf. So when we work on legislative issues, and if you're a police chief in the Commonwealth, you're eligible for membership, and they meet monthly, and they do a lot of good things. They do a lot of fundraising. Mm-hmm. They're very big supporters of the Dana-Farber Institute and the Jimmy Fund.
Nice.
And so I have been a member since I became the interim chief. Mm-hmm. I'm not a very active member. Like, I've never looked for a leadership role. But when I became a post commissioner in 2021, one of the reasons that was possible is the Chiefs Association putting my name forward to the governor's office. And and talking with my colleagues, they did that for a couple of different reasons. Hmm. One was they knew my background in training, and they wanted somebody who was a trainer looking at the stuff, because we knew that the use of force regulations were going to be written there. We knew there's going to be some training standards developed there. So they wanted somebody who had been in the academies to have some input. And they thought it was important that Western Mass be represented, because the governor and the attorney general were going to make these appointments, and we knew it was going to be pretty Boston centric.
Yeah.
And so I was humbled and honored to take that appointment as one of the inaugural post commissioners. But the governor was very clear when we spoke about it. He's like, you should basically anticipate having a second job for the next couple of years.
Hmm.
And it wasn't as bad as he said it was going to be, but it was a lot.
Yeah.
It's been a lot. And so, you know, fortunately, most of the meetings have been virtual, but attending Mass Chiefs executive board meetings to keep my fellow chiefs apprised of the developments with Post, attending Mass Municipal Association meetings and trainings to teach town managers and human resources people about the changes that are coming to Post. And so, I didn't have any detailed conversations, but one of my colleagues, Chief Pachorek of Deerfield, he told me, he put my name forward this fall, and they put my name forward because they appreciated the work that I had put together to get through that first bumpy development part with the post commission. And so I was fortunate, based on my membership in the post commission, to be selected and received so Christina and I drove out to Salisbury on Wednesday night, because the award was presented at the December meeting where the new officers were installed. And so my friend and colleague, Chief Tom Fowler, is the chief in Salisbury. He was being sworn in as the new president of Mass Chiefs. And I was very pleased for his predecessor, Chief Bradley, and Chief Fowler to present me with this recognition. I made brief remarks, and I said, you know, I thought being permanently appointed as a police chief in 2017 was the highlight of my career. And then I thought being asked to sit on the post commission was the highlight of my career, but receiving this recognition from my peers is definitely, that among my greatest accomplishments.
Yeah.
So it's humbling, and It's kind of cool.
Oh, fantastic.
And I put a post up late last night. It also comes with a $500 donation to the charity of my choice.
Okay.
And so I picked Blue Help, which is a national organization that encourages mental health and mental wellness for police officers and intervention services. So
nice. Well, such great news, and love it. And I totally agree with you that it's important to get that recognition in Western Mass from, like you said, most organizations in the Commonwealth, we know are Eastern based.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot more population there. And how many police chiefs are there in the Commonwealth?
About 330 thereabouts.
So yeah, a lot.
And most of folks. Them are from small towns, and many of them, they're the only member of the department.
Ah, right. So, and we know about that being here in Western Mass, that there's a lot of times a chief of police and a town hall and a town clerk, and that's pretty much it.
So it's interesting because I'm a city chief of police. Pittsfield is the smallest police department in the Commonwealth. It's eligible for membership in the Mass Major City Chief. So I'm also a member of that organization.
Okay.
But I'm the smallest PD in MMCC, the most remote from Boston, and we have one of the largest geographic footprints.
Mm.
Spread out.
Yeah.
So it's a weird combination. And although I'm not a small town police chief, my fellow chiefs in the Berkshire Law Enforcement Council, Berkshire chiefs are, and I frequently find myself advocating for them. So we'll put documentation or guidance or regulations together at the state level now through POST. And so one of the things we're working on recently is minimum standards for police officers to go into schools and be a school resource officer.
Mm.
And one of my colleagues suggested a minimum of 2 years of college.
Okay.
That's great. That's aspirational. I think we should hold that out there.
Mm-hmm.
But if we put that and make it a requirement, these small police departments that have 3, 4, 7 people, most of them in the high school, they won't be able to
appoint
anybody.
Right.
And they're all required to have somebody named as an SRO. So you have to balance these.
Mm.
And so I'm frequently saying, hey, great for Boston, good for Pittsfield,
yep.
Not so much for these small towns that I have to speak up for. And I love my fellow post commissioners. I really have enjoyed my service, but they don't have that experience. They can't think from a small town perspective.
Right.
And the other two police officers on the post commission are both Boston.
Yeah.
So they've got a big organizational view. I'm like, we've only got a handful of people.
Sometimes I think we have a little bit of a better perspective here in the Berkshires, although we don't have the big city perspective, right? If we live here, we only visit there. And a lot of people have more connections to that. But just the idea that we can understand what it's like to be in a city, but then also know that only a town or two over, we've got very rural
towns.
Yeah.
I was sitting at the table for the ceremony and luncheon yesterday with the a woman from one of the companies we do business with for police equipment, and she's inside 495, right? She's a city girl. She's been out here. She's come to trade shows. She's been out to, chief meetings at the log cabin in Holyoke, but she had never driven farther west. And so she had to go to a New England Chiefs thing. It was in upstate Vermont, and her GPS took her out here and over up 7.
Okay.
And she's describing her experience driving through Vermont. She's like, it was like being in the Midwest. Like, I've been to the Midwest. Those are mountains. We have hills, right? But if you're living in Boston, this is different.
Yeah, very different. Yeah, for sure. Culture shock, just like it is for anyone who spends most of their time in the Berkshires and then finds themselves in the city for a couple of days.
Absolutely.
It's a very, very different experience. So let's talk about decision to retire. Here we are. Your identity as a police officer, a leader in the Pittsfield Police Department, the chief of police in the city of Pittsfield, and you come to this crossroads. Here we are.
So I spoke about it a little bit in the public announcement when we were in the mayor's office, and some of it is very personal.
Sure.
But I had been thinking about looking at a career change for a couple of years now. First approached my wife about it probably in 2019. And to be honest, in our conversations at the time, the decision was purely financial, right? I'm invested in our pension system. I got a lot of time in here.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was like, I think it's a mistake. You've earned this. You should stick around, get your full pension. And if she had maintained that position, I probably would have done that.
Hmm.
But 2019, 2020, 2021, those are difficult years in law enforcement based on national events, so a couple of local events.
Yep.
They were difficult years as a post commissioner, writing use of force regulations following the death of George Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
And so this past summer, we were in a media cycle where, you know, not only were some criticism being lobbed at the department, but, you know, some attacks at me personally. Mm-hmm. And she and I went for a walk, and she just stopped in the middle of the walk. She's like, I changed my mind. It's time to go. And so I started thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, what is this going to look like? What will the timing look like? In conversation with the mayor, saying, just going to give you a heads up, I'm thinking about this. And then later this summer, I had a minor, I am fine, but I had a minor health scare. Mm-hmm. And got some bad news from the doc. Mm-hmm. And everything's good now. But the conversation with my wife and the two episodes with my physician and the hospital, I'm like, enough. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so those things came together. And then simultaneously, Christina and I had been going through some stuff with our family and decided to start our family, and, you know, a couple different efforts going on, going through some tragedy. But ultimately, we were screened by the Department of Children and Families as pre-adopted foster parents. And so in October, we got a call, and we brought our son into our house. And that's
amazing.
That was the final decision point.
Yeah.
I don't want to be raising him and be on call and running out to crime scenes. Mm-hmm. And so it was, as I said, time to reprioritize and focus my attention home a little bit more.
Well, that's, first of all, amazing, and congratulations on that news as well. It feels like a lot of people over the last few years have reassessed where they are, what they're doing, and what their life looks like. And it sounds like a lot of that with other things layered on top, of course. Yeah.
I mean, we're of a similar age. We kind of came up during, like, the, you know, Wall Street rat race thing. Mm-hmm. You're chasing the dollar.
Yep.
At some point, you get mature enough to realize that quality of life matters, right? I could stick around until I hit my maximum pension, and then I probably wouldn't be healthy enough to enjoy the pension, right?
Right.
So I'll go out when I'm still, you know, young and healthy, and I can enjoy the things I enjoy and participate in the activities I can participate in.
Yeah.
And you know, I've seen too many cops stay too long, and then their retirement life is just a reflection, looking back at you know, their heyday. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do that.
Yeah. Well, that's a perspective, and everyone makes that decision for themselves. And, so best of wishes. You got plenty of time left, but, short timer, as they say.
Not quite. There's a lot of work to do in the next 6 months.
Well, and let's talk about what's happening out there, right? So there are leadership changes, command shift changes, and then there's this discussion about future police station, which we can discuss, but that's a little bit off in the distance for sure. What happens next?
We're still trying to figure that out. So it's still a civil service position. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to negotiate that. I haven't heard any clamoring from the community. I'm sure there's going to be some movement to eliminate civil service from the position. That's a political process. It's lengthy. Yeah. It's certainly not going to be resolved before July. Mm-hmm. So whatever we do in the meantime will be interim. Mm-hmm. In an ideal world, the mayor and I would work together, and we would select one of my senior commanders, and they would step in an interim role as similar to as I did. Mm-hmm. And they would help the mayor negotiate the full succession plan. Mm-hmm. We've started to have some of those conversations. One of the flies in the ointment, as it would be, is a couple of them just don't want to do it. Mm. And they've you know, at least one has said, look, I've seen what this has done to you. I'm good. Well, I like my job.
And it's not for everyone. It's a different type of thing, right, than what you might have signed on for.
I think one of the things that I was not adequately prepared for, and that I've been honest with my commanders about, is chief of police is a much more political position than most cops would like it to be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've worked really, really hard to remain apolitical. I don't discuss politics mm-hmm. locally. And I don't participate in local politics. Mm-hmm. But chiefs of police have to make decisions, staffing decisions, resourcing decisions, and those become political. Mm-hmm. And then you have to establish a position and inevitably the position you establish as the chief is going to align with somebody's position or be in opposition with somebody's position, and now it's political.
Right, right. Or now it appears as if you've aligned with someone else's views, where actually what you've done is made the decision you have to make.
Just and trying to do the right thing for the department and the city.
Yeah, so that's different, and it is a political job in some ways, in terms of things that happen. External and internal events, I would imagine, drive some of that.
And the other thing is that there's at least some portion of the population that thinks it is political.
And so, all political.
Yeah. Right. And so they're like, you know, we're going to vote you out. Mm. No, you're not. I'm an appointee. You know, I've had people say, I'm not going to reelect you. I said, you didn't elect me the first time, right? I'm not an elected official.
Yeah. And in a way, that's where civil service is good, right? Because you can't just be blown out with the wind on someone, a political whim of someone saying, well, you know what? Because I ran on such and such a platform, this is part of my platform, and that's going to change.
I won't get into any of the details of this. Early in my tenure as the chief, there was some stuff going on locally in politics, and it was, you know, directed to release some crime statistics, and so I did it. Mm-hmm. And we released crime statistics; they're up on our website. And the facts contained in those statistics and the timing, they impacted races, right? Mm-hmm. And so now you've got people that are like, Mike did that because of this. Like, no, we released crime statistics, right? I was told to release the crime statistics. So everything becomes political.
Yeah. Let's talk about a couple of big issues. New police station, been talked about for a long time. Obviously a very complicated and costly project. Do we get one in the next 10 years, you think?
No progress on the new police station thing, unfortunately. Yeah. That's frustrating because I made the mistake of saying early in my tenure as the chief, I'll be here until we build a new station. I didn't think it was going to take 15 years to get to. So it's... There's a lot of different moving parts, and we've looked at this a couple different ways. You know, do you renovate an existing facility? Do you build new? Mm. Do you do it on current city property so we don't affect the tax rolls, or do we look at another piece of property that's better suited, but now we're not going to generate any tax revenue? Yeah. And all of these elements come into play. And, you know, we've looked at a couple existing buildings to try to retrofit. That's not always ideal. I know, like, you know, North Adams PD is moving.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's even more expensive. Mm. We've looked at city properties, some pluses, a lot of minuses.
Mm. But it has to be built to a certain standard, right? It can't just be an ordinary building that you're going to move into.
So the things that people don't take into consideration when, because, you know, I've had people say, just move into Pittsfield High School. That's not going to happen. It wouldn't work. So the things that a police department, a city police department has to have that people don't understand is, first, this facility has to be secure, right? It's a critical infrastructure facility. We have to have the ability to secure it. It needs to have an equipment storage and armory because we keep secure, sensitive items that need to be locked up.
Right.
It needs to have evidence and drug storage. Mm. So that has to be an individual secure inside the secure because those are restricted access. And then I think the biggest one that people forget is it has to have prisoner handling and holding facilities. And by law, those holding facilities have to be sight and sound segregated by age and gender.
Wow.
And so when you start designing a police department from the ground up, it gets real expensive real fast.
And how many of those things do we have in our current police station?
We have all of them, but we jammed them in. Most of our evidence storage is in safes and vaults. And those vaults were originally constructed for vital records and money. Because when the building that is now police headquarters was built as a federal project in the late 30s, there was 7 city departments in that building.
Wow.
And we've pushed them all out and expanded. So you grew up in North County.
Yeah.
I don't know how familiar you are with that facility when we were kids, but our crime lab at 39 Allen Street now is in the space that was the public health lab when I was in elementary school.
Okay.
My mom thought I had strep throat. She took me to that building. We went up the north stairwell from Dunham Mall stood at the window that is now the door to the crime lab, okay. and they swabbed my throat and took a throat culture, and then we found out if we had strep throat. So we pushed health out, yep. and we took over that lab. We pushed veterans out and took over that space. At one point, in the basement of the police station was a surgery, a city surgery.
Really?
Yeah. So, wow. you know, we've converted the range to property and evidence storage. We've converted a bathroom into an interview and interrogation room, public health lab into a crime lab. The first interview room for child victims of sexual assault was built before the kids' place existed in the basement of the police station. It's a two-room suite with a one-way mirror. That's now, half of that is a supervisor's locker room. Half of it is a special response team operations room. We've just expanded to the hilt, and now we're bursting at the seams. We're in the process of bringing on, well, so we brought on the department social worker in the process of bringing on the co-responders. We don't have any office space for them.
Right. And that's been a big issue in the last year or so now is, okay, we need folks to be co-responders, and there's a big public outcry to make that. And I think it's a positive thing. And then you think about all the knock-on effects. Okay, where are you going to put them?
Yeah.
And how are you going to hire them? And what are they, you know?
Yeah, so our co-responders basically work out of the back of our roll call room. They put their equipment on a table back there. Yeah. And
but that can only last for so long, right? So at some point.
Well, it's been working for 7 years.
and 7 years? Yeah. And the police building itself is coming up on, what, 85 years old?
Yeah.
Somewhere in that range. Yeah. So the building doesn't owe us anything. But the question is, will there be funding down the road to build something right. or modify something that will be an acceptable and useful police station?
Yeah, and so, you know, the local conversation is go get funding, you know, go get a grant. And there's no programs to fund public safety facilities right now. There were, but at the time when those grants were available, there wasn't the political support. Literally, former city councilors made a public statement. They're practicing community policing. They don't need a station. And while we are practicing community policing, you still need a place to write reports and take the prisoners.
Yeah.
So there
are functional things that are required.
Yeah, and our support services need a home, right? They need to be able to do their work to pay the bills and do payroll and keep the records. And you know, that's another thing that people just don't understand. We have a massive public records demand. We have to retain a lot of records.
And speaking of retaining records, that leads me to my last question, which is only 2 minutes long here. Body camera program coming fairly soon. The trial is upcoming. There were some bumps on the road.
The trial isn't underway. We've been 2 or 3 weeks now. Okay. We've got 8 units out there. The officers, the first group of officers is probably coming up to the end of their time. We'll select the second group to transfer them to and do some more evaluation. We're only looking at cameras from one vendor right now. The second vendor that I spoke about at the last city council meeting I attended, they have reestablished contact and established interest in at least going through the T&E. But similarly, you know, they send me an email and say, we're not responsive. We want to participate. And say, okay, when can you get me the cameras? So 8 weeks. You told us 8 weeks, 8 weeks ago, right? So,
and there's probably some supply chain issues there, right? With everything's hard to source these days.
There's that. But for me, the frustrating part is, each of these vendors has a model for what they think a T&E should look like.
T&E being?
Is testing and evaluation. Mm. And so this company is like, we'll send you a couple cameras for a couple of weeks. And we were insistent that we were going to establish a standard based on the most stringent available. And so the current company we're working on this said, we'll send you this many units. Take as long as you like. We'll do this. You know, here's the time frames. And so we told the other vendor, we want the same terms. And, you know, they balked, right? They're going to say they didn't, but they did. They were like, we don't think that's necessary. We can do it faster. So we don't want it faster. We want it right. Give us what we're asking for. So they agreed, but they haven't shipped the cameras. So
still some things to iron out there in the long term, but when do we think body cameras will be in regular use in Pittsfield?
If we conclude the T&E on the time fashion that we hope to, we got some grant funds that came in. We have to get those accepted. We'll have to do an appropriation. I know Finance Director Kerwood is hoping to do that in January. If we get all the pieces in place in January, we can probably have full implementation by late spring, early summer. Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, what prompted me to think about that was the records retention, right? Yeah. So now you're also retaining
data, storage.
Data, video.
Well, the good news is, since we started talking about this, you know, nearly a decade ago, now it's all cloud-based, right? So I'm not thinking about buying servers anymore.
That's much better.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it always brings up more and more issues. Every time you add something, you have to consider all the rest of the effects.
That's the part of the body camera conversation that people outside of law enforcement don't want to have. The expense is not the equipment.
Mm-hmm.
The expense is the data storage and retrieval.
Yeah, and management of it. Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, Chief Wynn, it's been great having you here. Time flew by.
Thanks for having me.
I've got a whole bunch of questions that I'm never going to be able to ask you, but thanks for being here. Best of luck with the future.
You can send us the questions, and we'll try to answer them on our show.
That's perfect. We'll do that sometime. All right. Thanks, everybody. Have a great weekend, and be careful in the snow. I think it's lightening up a little bit out there, but don't be fooled. It's going to be a big storm. Talk to you later. See you next week.